Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of The Sacred. A few weeks ago, I took part in an event at the Royal Institution in central London. It was called Between God and Atheism, Consciousness, Cosmos and the Meaning of Life. So just some small topics to chew on. It was a panel event with myself, Alex O'Connor, Philip Goff, Rowan Williams and Jack Symes. And we had a really fascinating evening's conversation. So we thought we'd share it with you here. Hope you enjoy it.
Hello, everybody. So many people here. Welcome to Between God and Atheism here at the beautiful Royal Institution Theatre. Thank you all for being here on a Friday night as well. We were overwhelmed with the interest in this event. We sold out in just a few weeks, and it's great to see so many people filling the chairs, young and old. I was about to say there's lots of beautiful faces in the audience, but some of you are in the dark, so those people look fantastic in the dark. Just at the back up there. We've got an exceptional panel for you this evening, some of the best and biggest thinkers in all the philosophy of religion. So please join me in giving them a huge welcome, as you did for me just then. I want it even warmer. I want it to feel like the flames of hell, if anything, in the warm introduction you give them. So without further ado, please welcome to the stage, fully alive, Elizabeth Oldfield. The 104th Archbishop of Canterbury, Professor Rowan Williams. The man with the greatest conceivable mustache, it's Alex O'Connor. And last but certainly not least, finely tuned in logic and looks, is Professor Philip Goff. So we've set ourselves an enormous task with some of the biggest questions in all of philosophy and science. We're going to be discussing where the universe came from, why it's finely tuned for our existence, and what the point of it all is, what the purpose of life is, more generally. To my right, we have two people representing traditional theism or Christianity, and to my left, we have those who are opposed to that view in some shape or form. So I'm between God and atheism, perhaps. Between a rock and a hard place. I'm going to ask each of our panelists to begin tonight by just giving an overview of the story of the world and our place within it. Then we're going to move on to critiques of atheism and have our atheists defend their worldviews before moving over to our theists and vice versa, and seeing if we need to carve out new alternative concepts of God along the way. So, Rowan, I'd like to begin with you. I'm going to give you the big question right away. What's the point of us existing?
In 3 minutes and not more. As a Christian, my starting point is that we exist because the most fundamental form of activity, energy, call it what you like, that is there, is love. That is, it's a willingness that the other should be. The world exists because God desires there be an other. And so love is fundamental to that. And so our point in being here is to receive that, to realize it step by step, day by day, to grow into what is possible for us with all the help we can get, frankly. That means two things which I think perhaps need saying when we're talking about faith and whatever faith isn't. First, it's not as though God is a kind of extra item in the universe who might or might not be there. God is as present in the universe as Bach is in the St. Matthew Passion or Beethoven in the symphony. It's that energy, that shaping energy, which makes it what it is, but it's not a thing within it. And sadly, both religious people and not so religious people often think that religion is just believing there's one more thing in the universe than others think. Not that. Second thing, though, is that for me it's absolutely basic to understanding where I'm coming from as a believing person to think that belief is an enhancement, an enlargement of what it is to be human, which is where not only the hope and the discipline that I try to live in makes sense, but also gives shape and purpose to how I look at the world around, both the human and the non-human world, to see what it is that can be done here and now by me to enrich the life of what's around me, to help the life that's around me become itself more life-giving, which is the ethical responsibility that I have as a believer and the responsibility I have also to the whole of the created order. So that's where I'd start, I think.
Oh, great. Philip, let's go over to you next. What's the best explanation for why we're here and what's the purpose of us being here?
Right. Well, I think many in the West feel they face a choice. Either you have to believe in the very traditional idea of God as all-knowing, all-powerful, perfectly good, or you're a secular atheist, right? It's like, whose side are you on, Richard Dawkins or the Pope? Make your mind up, quickly. And I've come to think that actually both sides of this never-ending debate have something right and something wrong. Right, traditional believers struggle to explain the horrible suffering we find in the world. Why would an all-powerful, loving God choose to create us through the horrific process of evolution by natural selection? But there are also things atheism struggles to explain. For example, the fine-tuning of physics for life, the surprising discovery of recent decades that for life to be possible, many numbers in physics had to fall in a certain very narrow range in such a way that it's incredibly improbable that our universe would have got the right numbers by chance. So we're in this situation where the believers are tying themselves up in knots trying to explain suffering, the atheists are trying to tie themselves up in knots trying to explain fine-tuning, when in fact there are middle ground options that can elegantly account for both of these data points. Consider, for example, the hypothesis of a God of limited power, a God who's made the best universe they can. Maybe God simply can't create complex life in an instant. Maybe the only way God can create intelligent life is by creating a universe with the right physics that is eventually going to evolve intelligent life. And God's like, I'm sorry, I know it's going to be messy. This is all I can do. Is this or nothing? I think this hypothesis can account for both the fine-tuning in terms of God's purposes and the suffering in terms of God's limitations. I really believe this is where the evidence is pointing, and I suspect it's biases on both sides that are stopping us seeing that. Now, finally, you might think this doesn't seem to fit with the religions that have traditionally dominated the West. Well, I've come to think that this God of limited powers hypothesis fits quite well with a certain slightly heretical version of Christianity. A version of Christianity where God isn't interested in finding someone to punish for our sins. Rather, God is focused on unifying herself with the universe, bringing God and the universe into a state of deep, intimate unity. I've recently argued that this form of Christianity fits with modern science and liberal values and can make good sense of the meaning and purpose of our lives. So I'm someone who for 30 years thought Christianity was a load of bollocks. But sometimes when you look at the same thing from a slightly different perspective, it could start to make a lot more sense. And that's what I found recently with this slightly unusual form of Christianity.
What are you doing? You're supposed to be atheists. Christians?
This has all happened since you invited me, sorry. Sorry. Let me down the atheist side.
Don't worry, I haven't become an atheist.
That would have balanced out.
Big news, Archbishop.
Big news.
Okay, Alex, as our one atheist on the panel.
I've got some bad news. Or good news, if you like.
No, unfortunately, I'm still an atheist. And I say unfortunately not just for the sake of this little joke, but also because I'd quite like to believe in God. Mm. Sounds quite nice. I do think that Philip is right to say that there are sort of mysteries on both sides that can't be explained. For example, the existence of suffering. But let's not brush over that. We talk about it as if it's some kind of intellectual exercise. If we're confronted with two hypotheses, I think one good way to analyze them is to ask what we would expect under either hypothesis, and then compare it to what we do actually find. So what do we find? Well, a universe. That's pretty difficult to explain, especially because it's so finely tuned. One question is to ask why the sort of meta conditions of the universe are such that the constants have to be so finely tuned, why it is that they would have to be on a knife edge. It's almost as though God didn't want us to exist, and it's the tiniest little probability. There's an interesting argument to say that if you wanted to imagine that there was somebody who had invented some kind of game where you were pulling balls out of a hat, and you were trying to figure out what color ball this creator of the game preferred, and you pulled out a yellow ball. That might be good evidence that the creator of this game likes yellow balls, fine. But if you then looked inside of the hat and found that every single other possible ball was purple, you might think, actually, it seems like the creator of this game actually wanted the purple ball, and we happen to somehow get the yellow one. So there are lots of interesting heretical forms of Christianity that I do think account for this, such as the Gnostic tradition. The Gnostics, of course, believed that the universe, the material universe, was created by an evil demiurge. And that's the God of the Old Testament. Marcion, the man who compiled the first ever canon of the Bible, the first one, omitted the entire Old Testament because he thought that God was simply incompatible with the person and character of Jesus. So what did the Gnostics believe? They believed that there was some kind of higher creative God, sure, but that there was an evil demiurge creator God who created the universe. Well, what might that look like? Maybe the great power who sets the meta conditions tries to make it as difficult as humanly or inhumanly possible to create a universe. And yet, it's created anyway. That seems to be more in accordance, in my estimation, with a Gnostic theology of Christianity than with a traditional one. So the fine-tuning argument might work, but I think it works perhaps against the favor of the Christians on the panel. If we look at what we do find in the universe inside of the universe itself, what else do we find? A system of natural selection that Philip just mentioned, which does not just involve, but relies upon, the death and destruction of the unfit. It actually exactly reverses our ethical intuitions that the weakest and the most vulnerable are people we should care about. Natural selection does the opposite. The weak suffer what they must, and the strong survive. Survival of the fittest is the same thing as the death and destruction of the unfit. And I'm told that this is the mechanism that God chose to embed into the universe, making a lot of animals, by the way, obligate carnivores. Why would he do that? So that they have to maul each other to death. When a lion eats a zebra, usually the zebra is too big to be killed instantly, so it suffers for minutes in writhing agony whilst its windpipe is caught in the jaws of a lion. I'm told that this is compatible with an omnipotent, omnibenevolent God. Sure, it might be. I can't say it's impossible, but I ask you to think what's more likely. If you assume that there is an omnibenevolent invigilator, I don't think we would predict this. But on the hypothesis of naturalism, not only do we explain this phenomenon, we also come to expect it. So I think it offers a better account for at least this aspect of what we see in the world. And fine-tuning consideration is a difficult one, but ask yourself, just intuitively, if in, say, 80 years from now, you were watching somebody looking at an old screening of this recording, they're watching it in 80 years, and one of them says, gosh, can you believe it, they hadn't worked out the fine-tuning yet. That seems plausible. But can you conversely imagine them watching it and going, gosh, can you believe it, they hadn't worked out the problem of evil yet, they hadn't explained why suffering exists? It just seems to me more intuitively plausible that one of those problems is a problem that will be solved and one is not. But as I say, that's just a hunch.
Let's bring in Elizabeth. Elizabeth, I had the pleasure of reading your book over the last weekend. It seemed a lot more down-to-earth than the philosophy texts that I'm used to. So maybe your emphasis might be on the latter part of the question, like the purpose of why we're here, how we can craft our lives, rather than these speculations about the origin of the universe.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the origin of the universe. I wasn't there, so I don't feel qualified. And I don't find it that interesting. And so I started to ask myself,
why? I think
why?
You've got the wrong crowd for that.
Or rather, I'm I'm interested in why we do find it interesting. What is it about the origin of things that fascinates us? It's usually because we want to learn something about where we are now, right? We think it will tell us something about where we've landed now. I think fundamentally underneath, it's an identity question. It's closer to the yearning of an adoptive child to know where they came from. Who am I is what's going on when we ask about our origins. Do I matter? Am I, are we in this theatre tonight just the random meat shrapnel spun out from a set of accidental processes? Or were we meant? Wanted? Am I ultimately loved is what I think the big one is. Under all this, I'm just going to show my priors right here at the beginning. I'm not looking for an elegant explanation of data points, and probably that's why I'm not a philosopher. I'm looking to answer that question. Here's a poem. Statement of Teaching Philosophy by Keith Leonard. My students want certainty. They want it so badly. They respect science and have memorized complex formulas, and I don't know how to tell my students their parents are still just as scared. The bullies get bigger and vaguer, and you cannot punch a cloud. I have eulogies for all my loved ones prepared, but cannot include this fact in my lesson plans. The best teacher I ever had told me to meet him at the basketball court. We played pickup for hours. By the end, I lay panting on the hardwood and couldn't so much as stand. He told me to describe the pain in my chest. I tried. Couldn't find the words. Not exactly. Listen, he said. That's where language ends. One thing I will say about my understanding of the nature of the universe is that it is fundamentally relational. Ian McGilchrist says relationship precedes relata, which I don't really understand, but it speaks to something I intuitively know. That truth, the truth that we are grasping at together tonight, is not an isolated individual thing. It's only a few letters from the word trust, and almost everything we know because of the testimony of people we have chosen to trust. And that is as true about what we know about the origins of the universe as everything else. And so if anything's going to happen in this room tonight that is more than just mental masturbation, all of us trying to look smart and impressive and defend our tribes and our positions, it will require us to actually relate, to really listen to each other and to be prepared to say, and I'm probably going to say this a lot, I don't know. I yearn. I hope. I fear. And philosophy is getting better at making space for these epistemologies, not tidying them to the sidelines like a messy distraction in the quest for truth, not pretending that we are the machines that we ourselves have made, but people who are embarked, as Pascal said, thrown, as Heidegger said, out onto the open seas of these questions, together, making a boat for ourselves as we go from these threads of testimony and trust and honest questions and embodied relational poetic truth. And that's all I really know about the origins of the universe.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Please join me in thanking everyone for their opening remarks. So we've got not the difference we were expecting in views, but we've certainly got differences in views. We've got like an anti-philosophy of religion, analytic, treat it like another object in the universe approach, which perhaps you and Rowan both share there. God's not this hypothesis, explanatory thesis to be wheeled out to plug a gap in science or something. Philip's been converted by the argument for fine-tuning. And Alex is highly sceptical of Philip's conversion, given his reservations on the argument from fine-tuning.
Did I say that? I thought it. Did I say that?
You didn't make it. You made it pretty obvious.
Okay. Fine.
So, Philip, I want to come to you first, because there's three things perhaps interesting come to mind. The first is what perhaps you'd like to say in response to Alex's point from the get-go. Two points Alex raised I thought were interesting. One was this skepticism of fine-tuning, the ball example. We look in, we find one coloured ball, it turns out to be lots of balls of a different colour. So a skepticism about your basic fine-tuning argument. The second Alex raised was something like, given the things we find in the world, why not limit or reconfigure our understanding of God's moral attributes in some way? So look at the Old Testament and look at concepts of God which don't limit God's power, as you were suggesting, but some other attribute. So the first one is respond to fine-tuning. The second one is why limit God's power? Sorry, you're going to have a few here. And the third one is, I was told you had a hit on the head this summer, and I was wondering if that was to do with your conversion to Christianity as well.
I remember you saying you thought it knocked some sense into me. Should I give an example of fine-tuning, just in case people are not familiar with this? One of the most discussed examples is dark energy, the force that powers the accelerating expansion of the universe. And on our current theories, if that force had been a little bit stronger, everything would have shot apart so quickly, no two particles would have ever met. So you wouldn't have stars, planets, any kind of structural complexity. Whereas if it had been a little bit weaker, it wouldn't have counteracted gravity, everything would have collapsed back on itself a split second after the Big Bang. So for life to be possible, that number had to be like Goldilocks porridge, right? Not too strong, not too weak, just right. And there are many numbers like this. So I think in our standard ways of understanding evidence, with something called Bayes' theorem, in our standard ways of understanding evidence, this is evidence for some kind of goal-directedness in the early universe. And I honestly think, I'll come to those points in a moment, but I honestly think we're in denial about this as a society. I think it's a little bit like when we first got evidence that we're not in the center of the universe. And people struggled to accept it because it didn't fit with the picture of the universe they got used to. And now we scoff at those people, those stupid religious people. Why didn't they just follow the evidence? But I think every generation absorbs a worldview it can't see beyond. And I think something like that's going on with fine-tuning at the moment. One thing Alex said about fine-tuning is you said, oh, it's a problem that will be solved. I don't think it's a problem that will be solved. It's in our normal ways of thinking about evidence. It is evidence for some kind of goal-directedness in the early universe. Now, maybe the evidence will change, you know? Maybe the evidence will change. Maybe future physics won't have any fine-tuning. Maybe future physics will have more fine-tuning. All you can do is work with the evidence you have. And it's the definition of a bias to say, I'm going to ignore the evidence we currently have, you know, until some evidence comes along that fits the view I like better. But I think we do need to take this evidence seriously. I was interested by the thought that the Gnostic interpretation, I'd have to think more about that. The other objection, very finally, about why is God working within these narrow constraints? Well, maybe that's a worry for traditional theism. But if we're going for a God of limited powers, that would be my understanding of, you know, the limitations of the designer. So the designer is only able to create from a singularity, is only able to create physics with a certain form, and is created the conditions for life within those constraints. So I agree with Alex that suffering rules out an omnigod. That's fine, but we've got to take fine-tuning seriously, so that ought to lead us to some non-traditional theistic hypothesis. Maybe this Gnostic stuff, we'll have to think more about that.
Let's bring in Alex before we bring in Ronan.
I'd like to know what those limiting factors are. I mean, if we're supposed to imagine a God who can only do particular things, can only act within a certain framework of meta variables, where do those meta variables come from?
Well, every hypothesis, as Wittgenstein said, explanations have to start somewhere. You have to take something as basic. As long as the basic axioms of your theory are relatively simple. And I think it is incredibly simple to specify this designer's limitations. Take physics, take the numbers out, and then you've got a certain structure, and the thought would be God is confined to creating physics with that structure. Specifying the constraints of God is simpler than physics, and so that's, to my mind, a simple enough starting
point. So the point that's simplest for you to start from is not divine simplicity, no limitation, singular being of like classical theism, but rather a set of specified conditions that apply to as of yet uncreated things such as speed of light, expansion, dark matter, dark energy, strong and weak nuclear forces, that somehow these don't exist yet because God has not brought the universe into creation. There are no atoms, there is no strong and weak nuclear force, but somehow the constraining axiom of what the strong and weak nuclear force would have to be is some fundamental axiom of the pre-universe sort of abstract realm in which God resides. That seems to me a little strange, perhaps.
Why is it strange if it's incredible, if it's simpler than physics? We want a simple theory that can accommodate the data. Maybe the traditional God hypothesis with divine simplicity is simpler, but we want to account for the data.
Oh, I see.
So right. Richard Swinburne has a nice example. He says, before we knew the speed of light was finite, we took it to be infinite because that's simpler. But as soon as we get evidence to the contrary, we don't tie ourselves in knots trying to keep the speed of light infinite. We make the theory slightly less simple to accommodate the data. So what I'm suggesting is these limitations of God are slightly making the theory a little bit more complex.
By the way, I do agree that you shouldn't brush this argument aside. It's not like it doesn't count for anything. I should mention, I did actually recently become a geocentrist because somebody pointed out to me that since all motion is relative and is all observer dependent, it is as arbitrary to set your center point at the sun or at the big black hole in the center of the Milky Way than it is to set it on the Earth. In other words, motion is all observer relevant, and since the Earth is the only place with any observers, it is as metaphysically legitimate to say that we are at the center of the universe than anything else. So geocentrism is back, and the Catholics were right all along, it seems. I do think it's an important consideration. I consider it to be a mystery, but it does seem to me just personally less troubling in that direction. It's not even, in my view, the best argument for the existence of God. I don't know how much it moves the rest of the panel. It doesn't sort of personally move me in the way that like a contingency argument does, or even the ontological argument, which sort of really like you can do it from your armchair. It's amazing. The fine tuning, it kind of sounds like some kind of problem of physics that may never be explained. But maybe will.
It's not
and I don't know.
It's
before
not
you come back, let's bring in Rowan and Elizabeth on the same point. Rowan, you said in your opening statement, God's not the sort of thing which is another object in the universe. It's not, and what I take that to mean from Elizabeth's remarks too, is that it's not the same kind of hypothesis as we're usually talking about in metaphysics. It's not like Descartes' God, which fills a hole in our explanatory picture. So what do you make of Philip's conversion to Christianity through an argument like that? Do you think that's a... we want good reasons for our beliefs. Is that the right way to approach the God question?
I'm not sure I'd want to talk about right and wrong ways here, except that on the whole, it's of course not why people come to believe in God, and we'd all accept that. But it's one of those things which, if you do begin from something like the supposition of the reality of God, that makes sense. You know, it's a kind of happy byproduct almost. You might say, oh yes, so that clicks. If the world is created by a will of some sort, and I underline of some sort, well, maybe that's what you'd expect. But of course, the problem with all these things is we don't have all that many universes to compare ours with. You know, we're not sitting here with a range of imaginable universes and saying, well, on balance, that's how things ought to work, which is why this is such a very taxing question. And if I were trying to come at the suffering question simply from a philosophical point of view, I suppose I'd go back to the not wholly satisfactory but respectable argument that we can't suppose a God whose power includes the power to do what is logically impossible. God, as they used to say, cannot make a stone too heavy for him to lift. Is it the case that any conceivable universe would have certain conditions, as it were, built into it? Not external to God, not constraints in that sense. But if you're going to do that, that's what you're going to do. That a universe extended in time, for example, has built into it contingency development risk. Now, as I say, I don't think that's a watertight argument. I think it's one worth considering, and it's the one I tend to revert to if this is put to me as a theoretical question. But
it's never a theoretical.
It's never a theoretical question. That's part of the problem. And I don't, just as I'm not quite sure we get to the point where the fine-tuning argument is over and done with, and it's quite clearly settled one way or the other, even more, I think, with the issue of suffering, because I often say, well, what would it be to have an explanation that made you relax about animal suffering or human suffering, where you could just say, ah, oh, now I see, yes, that's fine. And I'm not looking for that sort of argument, but that doesn't mean I'm very comfortable with the position. I struggle, as I think most Christians do, with putting a theoretical framework around it. I suspect, and perhaps that's the best I can do, that it's something to do with the inherent conditions of there being any kind of universe, any kind of consistent and temporally extended universe at all. But
that's what it means to be in space and time and have a physical universe.
Sort of thing, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I want to go to Alex in just a moment, but I want to add Elizabeth's thoughts here. You had a quote really stuck out for me from your book, Elizabeth. You said, "I would like to put the apple back on the tree, please, because the knowledge of good and evil is just too damn painful." And a lot of your book is talking about how we can live and respond to evils and suffering. And although you're not a philosopher of religion, but you do consider yourself a theist, how do you reconcile this perfectly good, omnipotent, omniscient being with the evident suffering in the world?
I don't consider myself a theist, but I do consider myself a Christian.
You don't consider... Oh, okay, apologies. You don't consider yourself a theist.
It's one of those philosophy of religion terms that feels like arid.
We'll clarify the concepts at the pub. I won't make people sit through that.
I mean, I think it's... I became a Christian through a powerful experience of God's love, and then I tried for a while to be an atheist, and this was part of the reason. And if I'm ever an atheist again, and that may happen, it will be because of the problem of suffering. It's, I think, the big gaping wound in human experience, right? And so my the desire to explain it away or justify it always seems morally abhorrent to me. I think the kind of first right response is just witness. It's just to witness the fact that this is never theoretical. Everyone in this room will have a reason why this is not theoretical, right? And it often comes back to this thing about love. It's the loss of people that we love or the suffering of people that we love. Actually, the problem of pain, we can tolerate quite a lot of suffering for ourselves. For the people we love, not so much. For the loss and grief, not so much. And the traditional Christian responses to it, you know, the free will argument, that in our turning away from God, in our, the homo incurvatus in se, as Augustine says, humanity turned in on itself, as that definition of sin, our withdrawal from love, our turning our back on love, which is one way to think of the fall, somehow cracked outwards into all creation. And that's responsible for natural evil. Doesn't quite do it for me. The veil of soul making, you know, the idea that suffering is somehow helping us grow up our souls in its worst form, like morally poisonous. Nick Cave, others writing about suffering and grief at the moment, are gesturing towards something that feels like the suffering can deepen us and humanize us. There seems something true in there, but you need to take so much care with that argument. I don't resolve this. I just hold it, and I hold the tension of it purely because of Christ on the cross. Because an impassive God who looks on the suffering of creation as omnipotent, you know, omnipresent, whatever your kind of abstract labels for God are, I have no interest in. A God that comes close in solidarity with the suffering. There's a bit in Isaiah that Christians believe is a prophecy about the Messiah, and it says he was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, one from whom people turned their face. And a God who I don't understand why allows suffering but comes close to it and stands in solidarity with the suffering at all times and weeps, that allows me to hold it.
Well, if I understand you both correctly, the reasons why both of you don't embrace traditional theism, despite wanting to, perhaps in both of your cases, is the problem of evil and suffering. Do you want to come in on first on this, Alex, and we'll go to Philip after?
I mean, that and divine hiddenness, which is a kind of a subset of the problem of evil, because it would be an example of one of the bad things that has to be explained. I agree entirely, by the way, that the way that we're thinking about God is wrong, generally. I think that it's helpful to remember, as Aquinas pointed out, that religious language is all analogical. God is not powerful. God is not loving. God is not knowing. God is not any of these things. God is beyond the comprehension. These are just analogous terms. They're human concepts that we can allow to, that we can use to allow us to get a glimpse at the kind of thing that God is like. The one that really sticks through that might not be an analogy is love. And in fact, Rowan, you said a moment ago that, you know, God is love, and this is the sort of defining feature of God. And I like this analogy of Bach, the author of a piece of art, and that is the relationship God has to its creation. But I would say that if a writer, an author, writes a play, and that's the relationship they have with that play, and we're trying to figure out what kind of relationship they were trying to build with the characters in that play. If I read a book that involved the kinds of things that not just human life, but non-human animal life involves. I mean, there are theodicies that say that evil exists because of human free will, that it exists because it can deepen us in our suffering, for example. None of these apply to non-human animals. You can imagine a deer on its own in a forest somewhere, having a tree fall over, crushing its leg, dying in confused starvation. And I'm sometimes told that this particular incident is in some convoluted way necessary, that there could not be the universe and the planets orbiting the sun and the love that we share with each other were it not for the allowance of this deer being starved to death in confused agony. I find that very difficult to swallow. And if I read a book in which all of the characters were suffering, and in fact suffering seemed to be the theme of the book, and that if you asked somebody who hadn't sort of read Christian literature and just gave them a history of the world, what word would come to their mind if you asked them to ask for the defining quality of human life? All they have is a history book of the things that human beings have done to each other. What word do you think they would pick? How many do you think they'd have to get through before they got to love? If that's the book that I was reading, I think it would be a more interesting book, but I wouldn't think that the author loved the characters. And that is why I think it's the most difficult pill to swallow, especially in the case of non-human animal suffering. We're more worried about the particulars. Like you say, this is not some theoretical concept. People don't want to explain suffering. They want to explain their suffering. They don't want to say, why do people die of cancer? They want to say, why did my mother die of cancer? And any attempt that's ever made to explain this away as either necessary to procuring some higher order good, which, by the way, kind of makes it a hidden kind of good in itself, that this is somehow either the necessary prerequisite of the universe, or worse still, I think, somehow a convoluted part of the will of the Lord. Well, you can't have bravery without fear. So God allows this lower suffering to allow the high. Okay, what does that mean? That when we're faced with the suffering, what, we should celebrate it? Because what is less worthy, what is more worthy of celebration than the enacting of the will of God? Right? And if that's why this is all happening, then hey, we've got something to celebrate. I don't think so. I don't think it's just a hard pill to swallow. I think it's a defeating condition of at least the philosophical version of Christianity, which is why I'm so glad to hear that there are Christians who don't think that's what it's about.
Let's go to Philip before jumping back. Are you sceptical of these theodicies, defences, explanations of the existence of evil for similar reasons to Alex?
Yeah, I think this is really where me and Alex are on the same page. And I mean, I appreciate what Liz is saying about, you know, being a human is not a purely intellectual thing, and, you know, faith isn't a dry intellectual thing. It's about living in hope of a greater purpose and so on. But still, it is part of the human condition to try and have our best guess as to what reality is like. And it's kind of my job. And I honestly believe that the suffering we find, the rational conclusion to draw is that an all-powerful, loving creator is incredibly unlikely. I mean, almost, not impossible, but less than 1%. I mean, if I thought there were very strong arguments for such a being, and then I turned to look at the suffering, and then I think, you know, the rational conclusion to draw would be, well, you know, God must have some reason for doing this that I don't know about, you know, God's a bit cleverer than me. I must be missing something here. But I don't think that is the starting point. I think there are good arguments towards something godish, but they don't point us necessarily in the direction of an all-powerful being. So fortunately, I think there are arguments, strong arguments, pointing to something godish, but we also have to take the suffering into account, and I think that leads us to some non-standard form of theism. And then, ultimately we want to live life and we want to hopefully live in hope of a greater purpose and all that. That's what it's all about. But we do have to sort of still do the dry thing of thinking, what is reality likely to be like? And I think suffering just really pretty much rules out an all power.
By the way, can I just say that if a Christian is able to say, suffering exists, I don't know why God allows it, but I'm sure he has a reason, then I think I'm probably entitled to say, fine-tuning exists, I don't know why, but there's probably some kind of reason.
Yeah. But you see, it's plague on both your houses. You're both tying yourselves up in knots. Alex is tying himself up in knots to explain fine-tuning. Liz and Rowan tied themselves up in knots to explain suffering. There are hypotheses, optimistic hypotheses, that avoid all of this, not all of this worry.
We'll come back to you. I'm
still not sure who you
are. I'll stop.
Don't worry, your turn's next. You'll be on there. Liz, do you want to come back on Philip's point first?
So, I really don't mean to pour scorn. I think an honest intellectual question is a holy thing. Like, these questions are not unimportant. They are deep and meaningful. They're just some questions. And I think we get into trouble where we take the methodology of either philosophy or science and narrow all knowing and think this decision, this biggest, deepest existential decision, can only be made when we have fixed our model and twiddled our dials and up fine-tuning, down suffering, whatever it is, found some balance and out pops something we can be certain about that will bear our weight. I think Pascal said in the 17th century, and I still think now, it's a draw. If you use just philosophy and science, it comes out even. Like, there are some really good reasons to get to think there might be a God in the universe. There are some really good reasons, suffering being the primary one, to doubt that. You are embarked. You can maybe try and create a third way that you are, working on your own, like Descartes did in his room, a model where he stripped away relationality, he stripped away testimony, he stripped away inherited knowledge, he stripped away the body, he stripped away all these ways of knowing that down the centuries humans have found to answer these deepest questions to an entirely Descartes-centric theory of knowledge, and then just leave God in your model as your flicking, or, dial down power and dial up love, or whatever it is. I get it. I get the wrestle. I get the longing. But I don't believe in philosophical Christianity. I believe in Jesus. I believe in the God who's pulling on the other end of the rope, right? I think what some of these intellectual things can do, they can remove some of the barriers. They can make us less worried that we're going to be conned, or we're going to look stupid, or we're going to be stupid. And this is what Pascal's wager is all about. It's not really about betting. He was in conversation with Fermat. It's a bit of an in-joke with Fermat about odds, but it's really a way of saying you are not the reasons that you are deciding the way you choose to point your boat when you are embarked is less about reason and generally about something deeper, and you have to choose. And for me, it was easy because I had this incredible experiential encounter, and I feel the privilege and gift of it because many people long for it. That's what tipped the balance for me. But the periods where I've not had that, what tips the balance is what's livable and what's going to help me grow up my soul and love my neighbour and be some use in this world. I think it's this story. I think it's this path. Mm. I think it's this existential world. And so I just think we need to broaden the tools that we're bringing to these questions and say, yes, philosophy, yes, science, yes, poetry, which is why I read one, yes, testimony, yes, people.
So just a quick follow-up on this, Liz, because it seems you were converted yourself through a religious experience.
Mm.
Right, okay. And as Rowan was saying earlier on as well, people come to faith typically not through these sorts of philosophical arguments. They're brought into community and the like. So they're like, they're good descriptions of how people might come to believe in God. But if we don't tie that into like reason and argument and being a rational and a reasonable form of faith, we might end up with any old belief system, right? So you sort of want both, just to clarify, right?
Yeah, you're saying
you want it, like, you do want the philosophical Christianity alongside the lived experience of a Christian faith.
I don't think I ever want philosophical Christianity. I'm sorry. I want rigorous, thoughtful, intelligent, engaged, questioning Christianity. I think my instinctive hesitancy about philosophical Christianity is Descartes-centric, or it's Jack Sinzo-centric, or it's the putting of the individual human intellect in the centre of the system and then asking God to fit that system. You know, Descartes was like, you can stay, but you're just the flick at the beginning to set everything going. And Pascal said very specifically, not the God of the philosophers.
But what would you get rid of Aquinas? I mean, Aquinas was radically new philosophy at the time. Now it's the official view.
What did Aquinas say at the end of his life when he had a religious experience?
That's true.
What did he say? Yeah, I don't know.
He died leaving an unfinished Summa Theologica behind him. His friend and I think patron begged him, said, you have to continue this. This is the greatest work of Christian metaphysics the world has ever seen. And he said, I can write no more. What I've seen reduces my work to nothing.
Square language ends.
Yeah, and I imagine that when you brought up Pascal, I immediately thought of that quote. It was after his conversion. He had it etched into his jacket. Yeah. Not the God of the philosophers, the God of Abraham.
Fire.
And that's where I agree with Dr. Williams too, that this is not how people come to believe in God. No conversion story ever begins with premise one. Never happens.
Apart from Philip.
Apart from
Look, I mean, I would very much say we
I'm sorry, we're not ganging up on you.
Sorry, I can take. Sorry, I've got a bit of a cough. You know, I think we need to do both. I think, yeah, ultimately it is about experience and it's about community and it's about tradition and, you know, this slightly heretical form of Christianity I'm thinking about connects to how the Eastern Orthodox Church thinks about things, where there's less of an emphasis on sin and more of an emphasis on God and the universe coming into harmony, God becoming more like us so we can become more like God. So, you know, that's what it's ultimately about, but we do need both.
And can
we
I
do
say one
need
more thing
think,
and then I want to shut up and bring Rowan in because I really... Yeah.
Go on, briefly, because I do want to hear Rowan on a point which was brought up ages ago by Alex, but go on.
So I just want to say, what I respect deeply about you, Philip, is you've been going to church, right? And my thesis, I don't know anything, this is very presumptuous, is that the reason you've shifted is not because you've made some model work, it's because you've been going to church. That the hemisphere hypothesis, which, you know, you need to take with some care and not apply to everything, but that what you've been doing is taking right hemispheric forms of attention, collective, ritual, embodied, in-storied practices. And what we pay attention to and how we pay attention changes what we see. And, Descartes' incredibly left hemispheric, mechanistic, stripped back to the skeletal bones, flat, narrow version of reason is not going to get us anywhere good. But the form of attention changes what we're able to see. And if you keep doing what you're doing, I wouldn't be at all surprised if things continue to unfold for you. So it's not just theoretical, you're practicing as well.
Yeah,
and I think that's really important.
I'm going to bring in... I can't sit next to the former Archbishop of Canterbury and not ask for his views on these questions. Rowan, would you like to come in?
Yes, it sort of follows on a bit from what's been said, I think. We talked earlier a little bit about power. Alex, you said, as Aquinas famously puts it, it's all analogical. And we're not, in ascribing power to God, we're not saying God is the maximal possessor of all that we mean by being able to do stuff. And what it does mean, well, there's a lot in Aquinas about it, but you don't start by simply projecting my sense of what I can and can't do and kind of leaving the top end a bit fuzzy. People talk about the power of God mostly because, and I think this connects with what Elizabeth was saying, mostly because of a sense of two things. One is are being overwhelmed by what you're confronted with, something unconditional or something utterly unexpected, utterly out of your ken. You talk naturally enough about power in that sort of setting, but it's a slightly different grammar at work. And the second thing, I think, has something to do with trust. I've no idea how this is going to work out, and it looks pretty bloody. But I'm actually not going anywhere. I stick with the trust that I've lived my way into. Now, both of those have something to do with, I suppose, coming at the notion of divine power from a slightly different starting point than just what's possible, even in the terms I was outlining earlier. So I guess that's how, as a matter of fact, believers live with this, with that uneasy awareness, as I said before, that there's an enormous lump of unfinished business at the conceptual level. And I certainly don't like the idea of philosophical religion as such any more than Elizabeth does. On the other hand, I do think that we've got a bit of a responsibility not to be manifestly talking nonsense. And that the labour we put into that is itself a holy thing. Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas, at the end of his life, certainly said, "Everything I have written seems to be like straw in the light of what I've seen." On the other hand, it took him 30-odd years of consistent philosophical labour to get him to that point. And it's something I've occasionally said about this tradition of negative theology, or the introduction of the mystical and the unsayable. You've got to say quite a lot before we come to the boundaries of the unsayable. You can't just say, "Oh, it's all a great mystery," at stage one. First difficult question, so it's all very mysterious. You go on until, borrowing Wittgenstein's analogy, the spade is turned. There's no way you can do with it.
Can I push you just on Alex's point earlier, though? Because he made the argument that your omnipotent God isn't confined to making it necessary that we need hurricanes for hurricane relief funds. Maybe for Philip's God, God's limited by the laws of power, by the laws of nature, so you can sort of get away with this one. But I think Alex's rebuttal to
limited by what is logically imaginable. What does any system entail in terms of risk and loss? I don't know, but that's what I was trying to say. I don't think, though, that particular problem is much helped by the Gnostics. Let's say you have a sort of remote, all-powerful God who's actually not very interested in what goes on, and he has a malicious or incompetent deputy. You still have to ask, well, where does the malice or the incompetence come from in that deputy? It's the classic problem with Gnosticism. If you push this back to first principles, either you have two equal and opposite, even a good principles in the universe, which is something Augustine deals with fairly effectively, I think, or you have the problem of a putatively good God handing over all the important stuff to a sorcerer's apprentice. It makes a complete pig's ear of it.
It's certainly complicated. The Gnostics have a very spelt-out theology. I think the best place to see it in detail is probably the Gospel of Judas, which is actually quite unreadable if you don't have some kind of guidance. But don't get me wrong, the idea that there are these archons and eons and beings and emanations and stuff, which is what you find in this text, this pre-180 AD text, by the way, is strange. But look, I mean, so is the Trinity, so is the philosophy of atonement and crucifixion, so is the very existence of a good God who is singular given the face of the world, given the state of the world. Everywhere there is mystery. Mystery sort of abounds.
The point, though, is that if you're looking for some sort of conceptually tighter account of what's involved in creation, I don't think Marcionite Gnosticism helps you very much in separating
and
that.
And by the way, I'm not a Gnostic. People, like...
good.
Often... seem to think, I get told off by Christians all the time for bringing it up as if I'm obsessed by it. I'm fascinated by it as a historical point. And it's not some, by the way, you know, random little sect in the history of early Christianity. There was one early church father whose name I have forgotten, who advised early church communities traveling in the East, when they get to a new town, do not ask to go to the Christian church. Ask to go to the Catholic church, because the likelihood is you might end up going to a Gnostic church. It was that sort of widespread. But of course, I don't think it works. I'm not a Gnostic Christian. I think it explains a lot more things that we see in the world better than the traditional Christian picture. But of course, it has problems of its own. But I think that trying to explain why there would exist some demiurgic material creator of the material world, given the existence of some other kind of good God. Hmm. Because, by the way, the Gnostics don't think that the demiurgic creator is a god. They don't think it's God. There's not multiple gods. It's a weird thing to try and sink your teeth into, but that, to me, is less a priori, if I may use a philosophical term, sorry, everybody, is less sort of intuitively plausible to me than the idea of a singular, all-powerful, loving God who yet creates the world that can only be explained by something like an either evil or incompetent demiurge.
A point that was raised earlier from Liz to Philip was on the type of view which you're embodying, the reasons why you're embodying it. You described yourself, Philip, at the very beginning as a form of heretical Christian. But besides going to church, which, you know, is pretty Christian, but, you know, Richard Dawkins goes to church and you wouldn't call him
I went to, I've been going to church as well, and I recently saw Richard Dawkins.
In the church?
Well, I saw him.
Are there no atheists left?
I saw him, I said to him, I said, like, oh, how are you doing, Richard? And he said, yeah. I said, we were in Oxford, and I said, oh, I sort of embarrassingly said, I was actually at Evensong last night. And he said, me too. Fair enough.
Well, it doesn't sound, though, beyond going. You know, Alex describes maybe an atheist, agnostic, the closest you would go towards a form of, like, metaphysical Christianity. But you're saying you're a heretical Christian, but it does sound a little bit like you just believe in a God of limited powers, and then you sort of just making up a bit of a religion at the end.
What's the Christian?
If I think of Christianity, I think Liz was talking about Jesus on the cross. I think of the Archbishop of Canterbury. I don't think just go along to church with Alex and Richard Dawkins and believe in the God of limited powers.
We'll make a date.
No, well, look, I mean, as we touched on before, I think the fact is, throughout history, religions have always, to an extent at least, reinterpreted themselves in the light of the science and philosophy of their time. Aquinas was radically different. Take another example. Christians no longer think it's a sin to charge interest, something maybe we've changed our view on in the light of the modern market economy. So, you know, I think at the moment, I think there's a kind of stultification, which I think may be due to the fact that we're going through a period of history where religion doesn't make intellectual sense to liberals and progressives on the whole, especially younger generation. Mm. And so religion tends to be more dominated by conservatives, especially in the US. Now, I don't hate conservatives, but I think often there's a natural balance between conservatives and progressives, and this allows you to preserve a tradition but update it in the light of our modern understanding of science and morality. And I think that's become a bit stultified in religion at the moment. I don't understand why so many Christians feel they need to sign up to the kind of Christianity that was formulated in the year 380 with the Nicene Creed. You know, why think those guys got it all totally right?
But what is your, you know? What is yours?
Well,
where does Christ come into your sort of Christianity?
So I
briefly, if possible, rather than giving the just
how much do we go into this? I embrace a form of Christianity which is very close in spirit to the way the Eastern Orthodox Church understand what the Jesus stuff was all about, which is essentially that the point of existence is for God and the universe to come into a state of deep organic unity, maybe what Jesus was getting at with the metaphor of the vine and the branches, that kind of deep, intimate relationship. But there's a problem.
Oh, so we're a bit different to God, right? Mm. God's the immaterial, timeless source of everything. We're just sort of temporal, contingent beings. So they kind of don't fit together. And so the solution to this is God becoming a bit more like us, taking on a physical nature, sharing in our form of existence so that we can share in God's form of existence.
And you believe he actually did that?
And this closes
the Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this isn't the ultra-liberal Christianity of like, oh, Jesus was just a
really, atheist.
Was a great moral teacher. And, you know, this is, there was, reality was transformed. God and the universe came together in some quite unique way in this moment.
Okay.
Very close to Eastern Orthodox Church, but fits really well with this God of limited powers view, which I think is very well evidenced.
So your argument is that we need to take into account this argument from fine-tuning. Christianity needs to evolve in line with, you know, what physics teaches us, right? And you think that somehow this all...
And our modern moral understanding. I think it's a development in our moral understanding that it's just inconceivable that a loving, all-powerful God would create a universe like this.
Okay. Very briefly on Rowan first, because you did want to jump in. Is this the kind of change that Christianity needs in order to sustain its numbers, keep the churches full and not just full of atheists?
Yes. I mean, it sounds a bit odd to say this, but actually, God forbid that Christianity should adjust simply to become more culturally acceptable. I don't think that's what this is about. That it should be constantly engaged in a sort of self-questioning, self-criticizing practice. Yes, for its own sake, because that is what the truth requires of us. I think some of my Eastern Orthodox friends will be a bit surprised at the, you know, the particular way you've characterized their approach, because they're quite keen on the Nicene Creed and things like that. What you've said is not a million miles away from what the Nicene Creed is saying. But the thing I wanted to come back to was something you said a bit earlier, and which I think Elizabeth has touched on as well, and that is something to do with the prevalence of secularism in large parts of our contemporary culture, especially among younger people. And I see it less as an intellectual issue, though it is that, more as a question of the fact that, particularly in Western Christianity, we've on the whole been presenting a somewhat disembodied and cerebral version, which doesn't give much priority or weight to sheer practice, by which I mean what a Buddhist might mean by practice. That is, the habit of meditatively being in the presence of the holy, the practice of attempting to open up one's life more fully to the influx of whatever it is that is to be received, the steady anchorage in habit, language, worshipping, all of those things. I hear you saying that that is a very significant element in what you're feeling your way around. And I think that's something which is not going to be addressed just by mopping up the conceptual issues or tidying up bits of the doctrine. I would want to see, if I wanted to see a sort of reform of Christianity, I'd want to see a somewhat retrograde reform which gave more weight to practice, in a sense, helping people to be silent before God, helping people to listen and attend, to look contemplatively, and, if you like, to go deeper. Because I think the hunger for that is palpable, and I think the disillusion and disorientation around the kind of Christianity that people like me are seen to represent has a lot to do with the fact that we're seen as just not knowing how to do it, really. Mm. Years ago, I remember a conversation with a young fellow academic in Cambridge who said, well, you know, all this stuff about Christianity is very interesting, but if I became a Christian, what would I do different? I thought that was a very good question. Mm. And I think there are answers. Well, and they're not just about feeling more loving towards disagreeable people either.
Liz, you wanted to come in just before Rowan a moment ago.
Yeah, just to say, I think it feels like a sort of base level obvious thing to say, but if God does exist, there should be a wildness, right? A beyond us-ness, a sense that we cannot trap the divine in a cage of concepts. And so for me, the fact that there's loads of stuff that I can't quite find an elegant solution for, the data points, doesn't seem like a necessary argument against belief. And I also feel very strongly that, and again, this is so easy for me. It's not so easy for me. None of it's easy for anyone, but I can only speak from my experience. You know, I can only do, I have found, come and see. My experience is that I don't think God cares whether we believe in God or not. Like, intellectual assent either way. The Christian claim is that God wants to love us and be loved by us, to sit and gaze on each other in silence, to know and be known. And we see only in a glass darkly, and then we will see face to face, right? Levinas says the sacred call of the human face, face to face. And so that sense, I always have to come back to, I'm sorry to bang on about Pascal all the time, but I think that was the shift for him. He talked about, you know, you can have an impersonal God or a life force, or you can try and be making all these things that don't make sense. They don't make sense. You're right. None of it makes sense. It's crazy. It's a crazy bunch of stuff to believe. Completely counterintuitive. There's no taming it. But the safe versions is not what I think those of us who have felt the gift of being invited inside to something or have felt ourselves able to surrender to it, it's not a safe thing. It's, as Pascal said, someone pulling on the other end of the rope. Right? And so I think that's why practice is so important. It's why these forms of attention are so important. If we want to believe, then it is only in a relational orientation of seeking and searching and being with others. And my hunch is, particularly these right hemispheric forms of attention that broaden our range of what we can see, is really more important than can we make this sum add up?
I want to save plenty of time for audience questions. So that brings to an end our free-form discussion. Please join me in thanking all of our panellists. So please raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll start off with the gentleman there in the blue shirt just above the clock. And then after that one, up in the balcony, we've got right at the very centre at the back there, behind the clock. Your question.
Thank you. So Philip suggested that Christianity has been subject to the accretion of new ideas over time, and bits of it have been updated, like we're now able to charge interest, and that's fine. What is the thing at the core, though, that has been there from the start and that you cannot derive from another source? Why call that Christianity?
Well, I mean, we've got... Let me start again. I mean, I'm not a biblical inerrantist, which means, you know, I think the Bible makes all sorts of mistakes, gets things wrong. I treat the New Testament as a historical document, but I think it's a damn good historical document, particularly the genuine letters of Paul, which are extraordinary by the standards of modern evidence. Sorry, by the standards of ancient history. So I think we just have to make our best judgment as to what was being conveyed there. The way I think of Christianity is that in the person of Jesus, God and us and the universe came together in a unique and unparalleled way. So as I say, this is not the ultra-liberal form of Christianity where Jesus was just sort of another enlightened person or something. That would be the core of it for me, I suppose, that God and the universe came into an intimate relationship in that moment.
Okay, a question from up in the heavens.
Philip, do you think that the anthropic principle supports or undermines your hypothesis for a God of limited powers?
So the anthropic principle, I suppose, is sometimes given as a response to fine-tuning, right? We couldn't have experienced a universe that wasn't fine-tuned. So it's almost kind of inevitable that we're going to experience a universe that isn't fine-tuned. There's a great response to this with an analogy by John Leslie, of a firing squad analogy. So imagine, sorry, I've got a terrible cough. Imagine you're going to be executed by five expert marksmen, and they all load up and they all miss. And they load up again and they all miss. And you think, this is a bit weird. And they keep loading up and keep missing and keep missing. And you think, something's going on here, this needs explaining. But you might think, well, this doesn't need explaining, because if they'd hit me, I wouldn't be here to observe, so I shouldn't be surprised that they've missed me. Something seems to have gone wrong there, right? Even though you wouldn't have existed if you'd been shot, it still needs explaining how come these expert marksmen keep missing, right? Maybe it's a fake execution. Likewise, yeah, we couldn't, if the universe hadn't had these exact right numbers for life, we wouldn't be around. So what? It's still incredibly improbable that you get the right numbers for life, and so it needs explaining.
Okay,
there is a thought experiment that explains, that attempts to explain that. We haven't done the fine-tuning multiverse thing. I wonder if I might just get a mention here.
You can have a mention if someone takes a microphone to the gentleman in the white in the centre chair.
Hugh Everett, the sort of founder of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is the sort of multiverse version of quantum mechanics, is said in some of his biographies to have privately believed in his own immortality. Why? Because if you imagine a Schrodinger's cat situation, but instead of a cat, it's you, and you can press a button that has a 50-50% chance of killing you or leaving you alive, Alan imagined that if you were to press this button, there would be sort of two realities created, one in which you live and one in which you die. And of course, the only one in which your consciousness can stem off into is the one in which you live. And so he imagined that if you had a sort of suicidal man next to this quantum button, sort of trying to press it, thinking that it's broken, but it's actually just because you sort of your consciousness necessarily goes into that version of events which allows that consciousness to obtain. The multiverse is often used as a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. I'm told by some physicists that there's some good evidence for it, but there's a potential explanation for that firing squad scenario.
Okay, question from the gentleman in the centre there. No chance in heaven and hell that you're going to get a word in there.
Thanks so much. A lot of the conversation tonight has been about suffering and love, and one of the points about suffering is, you know, if you added up all the suffering, you wouldn't say that we had a God of love. And that's probably true if you just look at the events of history, because it's all about wars and so on. But if we add up all the human experiences that somebody has, that one person has, is their main experience love, or is their main experience suffering? I imagine we can't necessarily answer that question, but when you take it right down to the individual moments of human experience, it may be somewhat different.
Let's go to Liz for this one, if possible. Do you want, unless Alex wants it?
I think people are generally very sort of overestimate the extent to which their life are going well. There's actually a I think it's called the Pollyanna principle or something like that. David Benatar, the antinatalist, talks about this a lot because he tries to convince people that it's immoral to have children. But not just this reason, but he does also convince you that your life is... He makes an argument that even if your life goes really well, it's still immoral to have children. And then the next chapter is, even still, your life is going much worse than you think it is, and here's why. So people are often sort of looking back much... that they struggle to identify the bad parts, and they sort of have an optimistic bias. I do think suffering abounds. Menial suffering, if suffering can be just defined as an experience which is not wanted when experienced, broadly speaking, you know, being a bit uncomfortable in your chair, having to walk upstairs, having to stand up and sit down, all of these acts that you don't even think about, when you actually add them up, it's quite a lot of menial suffering that goes on. There are menial joys too, but I think that if you were to do a calculus and add up all of those menial sufferings and all of those menial joys, I suspect the suffering would come out on top, but I don't know.
Okay, preference for a question
towards...
I'm just going
to think of that as the argument against God from uncomfortable chairs.
Quite. It is a small factor, but it is disconfirming evidence.
A preference for a question towards Elizabeth or Rowan, if possible. So please raise your hand if you have one. Just over here.
Question for Rowan and Elizabeth. So there are many different religions with different concepts of God. Why is it that you guys choose the Christian concept of God rather than any other religion?
To be honest, of course I didn't. I was born into a Christian family, grew up with that. And it's not as if I ever looked at a supermarket shelf of religions and said, I think I'll have that one. But that growing as I did, I found this continued to unfold and make the best sense I could imagine. Now, once again, with trying to assess the truth claims of different faiths, you're never in the position of somebody totally disinterested, totally detached. I can only say, this is what I've found to make sense, even when subjected to tough intellectual and emotional and moral challenge. It continues to be credible, and that's almost where I have to take my stand. I say, I've found it credible. Now, I learn repeatedly from people who belong to other religious traditions. I was just mentioning to Elizabeth, I used to spend 24 hours a month staying with a hermit friend of mine who had been shaped mostly by experience in a Buddhist community, but had remained a Christian. And their expertise in meditation, their insight in all sorts of respects, continued to feed me and to give me some sense that maybe it wasn't a zero-sum game at the end of the day. I've found interfaith dialogue and exchange constantly stimulating and enlarging. I don't think I've ever seriously thought, though, that it would make more sense for me to be something other than a Christian. And that's where I sit with that particular view of not only how the universe is, but also how the history that Phillips mentioned has worked out. So that's, yeah.
I was thinking then you might say you were converted to Phillips' God of limited powers. not today, mate.
Give me time.
If you spend enough time with him, he might convert you.
Well, then again, of course.
Liz, do you want to come in on the same question?
Yeah, I'd say something very similar. Obviously, there's a lot of contingency in all of this, and what are the chains of testimony and trust and love and relationship that we are thrown into? I had a period of trying to be an atheist, did some exploratory reading in other ways when I realised I was a terrible atheist and I could not sustain it. And the person of Jesus compels me. I find there's a lovely old hymn that says, "See from his head, his hands and feet, love and sorrow flow mingled down." And the way it can hold together, I think, like, is life all suffering? Is it all love? It's both. It's both. And in this story, they are held in this. I find it beautiful.
Okay, we have a question. Fantastic facial hair, second row centre. And we could probably squeeze in one more maybe on the balcony. I didn't think a human could stretch that high, so we'll go for that enthusiastic person.
So this is another question for the traditional Christian side. Forgive me, I'll keep it succinct, but it could be a big can of worms, because I wanted to actually get your view on where the concept of sin comes into this conversation, because we've had a lot of talk about the suffering in the universe and that kind of thing. But my understanding is when you read the Bible, it's not just God created and then everything went exactly the way he would prefer it to, but rather there was a plot twist near the beginning where basically we did something that really messed things up. So I'm just wondering where that idea of whether you call it sin or the fall or original sin or whatever, where that might relate to concerns such as Philip has raised about, you know, what do we do with the suffering around us? Where does that fit in?
A brief answer, if possible, Rowan, to a massive question.
Sorry.
No, don't be. I think you've crystallised it very well that in the Christian story, anyway, as soon as we were able to think, we started thinking stupidly. As soon as we started to act, we started to act self-destructively. Now, why and how, we can argue more about that. But it means that built into this version of the human story is the sense that from very early on, what we have been transmitting generation by generation is a set of skewed habits, misplaced obsessions, alienation from the real, the habits of untruthfulness. And when people talk about original sin, when they're being sensible about it, not everybody has been, but when they're talking about original sin, the bottom line is, this is the climate into which people are born. That's what we pass on to one another, generation by generation, which, if you like, poses some substantial extra problems in the whole story of renewing, releasing, restoring that humanity. Mm. And for me, the redemption story is not simply a matter of, oh, we were very sinful, and then Jesus arranged for us to have it all written off. But no, we were stuck, addicted, obsessed to untruthfulness. And somehow, through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, we're released into the possibility of living truthfully, or living honestly, or living in tune with what's real, i.e. with God.
By the way, some Gnostics believe that Jesus...
Are you sure you're not a Gnostic?
Some Gnostics believe that given that the world was actually created by the evil Demiurge, and that's the God of the Old Testament, you'll notice that the serpent is never identified. It's just called the serpent. There are some ancient Gnostic traditions which believe that Jesus was the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. Now that's a heresy. That's a real heresy.
I think I'll agree.
Right, a very final brief question from the balcony.
My question is for Alex. Each of the other speakers this evening have alluded or spoken about purpose that they see within the universe. From your more agnostic, atheistic standpoint, do you think there is purpose?
I don't know. I can't offer a comprehensive answer to that. If a 25-year-old atheist YouTuber could tell you what the meaning of life was, I'd feel a bit sort of shortchanged for everyone who failed to come to a conclusion themselves. I might have to bring up Pascal again. Pascal, I said this thing, I quoted Pascal recently on this question of meaning, and it seemed to be really popular. I think Pascal, he's maligned for the Pascal's wager thing. He should be remembered for so much more. He was considering the concept of boredom, and he imagined somebody who overcomes their boredom every day by gambling, and that's how they get rid of their boredom. He says, okay, well, imagine you just gave the gambler all the money that he could win every day. You just gave him the money that he could have won playing the game. You'd make him unhappy. Because that wouldn't alleviate his boredom anymore. Okay, says Pascal, imagine instead you allow him to play the game, but now he's not able to win the money. He just has to play the game. You'd also make him unhappy. So Pascal's like, what is purpose? It's something like playing a game where you don't know if you're going to achieve the thing, and that thing sort of being in the future. This is why I think religion does it very well, by the way, to be quite pessimistic about religion, because religion is the definition of something which you don't have now, think that when you have it, it will make your life better and will be on a sort of constant striving and gamble as to whether you're going to get it or not. That's a bit like playing the gambling every day. The reason that works is because if it's true, then you find out, and if it's not, then you don't. So I think that I can't tell you what the meaning is, in other words, or what purpose is, but I can, if I try to give an analysis of what meaning means, of what the kind of thing is that people are talking about when they talk about meaning, I think they usually identify it with something like that. It's having a task to fulfill. That's why meaning and purpose are synonymous. What is purpose? Purpose is a reason to act. It's having a task to fulfill. That's why it's quite ridiculous, I think, when people say, I just create my own meaning. Well, you just create your own sort of task to fulfill for the sake of fulfilling a task? I don't think that makes much sense. But I think that's why religion does it so well, not because religion is...
I must say, I found that an unrecognisably transactional view of religion, as if nothing I now do is really in touch with anything, and I'm gambling on the future. I absolutely don't recognise it.
Well, what is it that you think about believing in God, let's say, or believing in an afterlife, that imbues a life with purpose that it doesn't otherwise have?
I am my beloved's, and he is mine. The thing that I'm not waiting to see if I get something after I die. I have it now.
It's a relationship that exists in
like,
the
And the thing is, I completely understand why it sounds like madness, but...
So if you could have that relationship now...
I have this relationship now.
But life ends.
at death. There is no afterlife.
I would
there is
choose
no
it again and
God.
Again and
you,
again.
You might choose it, but would you still have a problem of nihilism? Would you still have this question that while you're alive, there are religious traditions which don't believe in an afterlife. Mm. They still believe in a personal relationship with their creator, but at death it ends. To me, that still carries the problem of nihilism. What is this all for? It just comes to an end.
I think you think religious people spend a lot more time thinking about the afterlife than they do.
Mm.
I should be more sceptical of enthusiastic questions. You've opened a massive question. That's always the way. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panellists and everyone working.